It's Philosophy Talk.
And now, a message from the President of the United States.
How can we know what would be true in another possible world?
In 2000, when you overwhelmingly made the decision to elect me as your 43rd president, I knew the road ahead would be difficult.
Al Gore might have become president in 2001.
What sort of fact is that?
In the last 6 years, we have been able to stop global warming. Glaciers that once were melting are now on the attack.
Can there be facts about what might be as well as what is?
What if the scientists are right and one of those giant glaciers hits Boston? That's why we have the lockbox.
What does it mean to talk about what might be true or false in another possible world?
As for immigration, solving that came at a heavy cost, and I personally regret the loss of California.
Our guest is Lori Paul from the University of North Carolina.
What might have been? Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hello, and welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus. That's where Ken and I teach philosophy.
Today, what might have been.
Many things that did not happen might have happened. For example, if I hadn't been such a procrastinator, I probably would have written a lot more stuff in my career.
And many things that did happen might not have. I went to Notre Dame, the University of Notre Dame, but I might not have. I could have gone to Case Western or MIT instead.
And some things are bound to happen. Unless you're immortal, you are bound to die.
Now, the distinctions among what actually happens, what might or might not happen, and what is bound to happen are what philosophers call modal distinctions. And today, we're going to explore the role that modal thinking plays in our lives.
So we're going to ignore the advice of that sage philosopher Willard Van Orman Quine. He said, ask not what a thing may or must be, ask only what it is. Not to mention Sergeant Joe Friday of Dragnet and his mantra, just the facts, ma'am.
But you know, John, Quine and Friday both got it wrong. Contrary to the good detective, talking about what might have been isn't just idle speculation, and as he thought, it's a way of sticking to the facts. And that's just because, contrary to Quine, in addition to facts about what is, there are also facts, real facts, objective facts, about what might be, must be, or can't be.
Well, I don't know, Ken. I mean, facts about what actually happened, I get. I understand. Something happened, that's a fact. You're a philosopher, that's a fact. What makes it a fact? Well, you went to a fairly reputable university, I'll give you that, for the sake of argument. Got a degree in philosophy, got a job teaching philosophy, published things in philosophy. All that adds up to your actually being a philosopher. But now, how about this supposed fact that you might not have become a philosopher? What makes that true? Some concrete property you actually have, then it's actual. Some concrete action that you actually took, that can't make it true that you might have been something else. I just don't get it.
John, your problem is you want to try to reduce facts about the possible to facts about the actual, but that, you know, that can't be right. There's just way more things that are possible than are actual. There's not enough room among the actual for the possible.
Ah, you're making me fondly remember Quine. I mean, you think that there's facts about the possible that are just primitive, further additional facts above and beyond the facts about the actual? How can that be right? How can we even know such facts? I mean, what is the world? The world is things happening. Once they happen, they're actual. The world isn't a stream of possibilities. It's a stream of actualities.
You really do sound like that grouch, Quine. He really was a grouch about possibility and necessity and that sort of stuff. But look, we confidently talk about things beyond the actual all the time. Look, especially when we engage in counterfactual reasoning. And that's kind of the bread and butter. That's reasoning about things that are explicitly contrary to fact. Look, I once thought hard about becoming a lawyer, but I didn't. And I'm glad I didn't, because here's another fact. If I had become a lawyer, I'd be a lot richer than I am now, but I wouldn't be nearly as happy. That's a fact, John.
That's a fact. Where am I going to find that fact? What makes you so sure that there's a fact like that? Maybe if you had become a lawyer, you'd have been one of those crusading do-gooders who's really happy, although poor. somebody more interested in saving the world than making a buck.
Look, I know that's a fact because I know a couple of things. I know that in general, lawyers are richer than philosophers. I know that ideas matter more to me than money does. And I know that my becoming a lawyer wouldn't change any of that. Ergo, it just follows, if I had become a lawyer, then I'd probably be richer than I am now, but far less happy than I am now. That's a fact, John.
Well, but look at how you just reasoned. You went from a premise about the way things actually are. Lawyers tend to be rich. Then you instantiated yourself into the antecedent. If I were a lawyer, I'd be rich, or at any rate, have more money than I do now. That's not really finding some kind of mysterious modal fact. That's just kind of reasoning based on what the world is actually like. Thinking about counterfactual possibilities is more tied to the actual than you're imagining.
Well, okay, but you know, thinking about the possible isn't strictly limited by the actual either. I mean, we can imagine remote possibilities far removed from the actual. And here's the thing, even remote possibilities are still possible. I know what your problem is, John. Look, it takes a real visionary often with a rich imagination to look beyond the actual and find the outer limits of the possible. Somebody like me, you know?
So the problem isn't with this mystical possible claptrap. It's with my imagination and that I'm not a visionary like you. I got news for you. Just because you can imagine something doesn't mean it's really possible. You can imagine all sorts of things that will never be and could never be. Faster than light travel, magic wands. Frogs that turn into princes upon being kissed?
Okay, look, I grant your point, and I grant that, as always, there are lots of really challenging questions to dig into here.
For example, just what are facts about what might have been? And how do they relate to facts about what actually is the case?
And how can we know anything about what might have been, given, as you say, John, that the world confronts us with a stream of actualities, of things actually happen, and not a stream of possibilities?
Clearly, our imaginations play some role, maybe the entire role, in allowing us to think about possibilities.
So, to get us started in our search for answers, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, the one and only Caitlin Esch, to learn more from some folks who combine highly developed imaginations with skill at counterfactual thinkings. That would be children. She files this report.
I think children's imagination is pure brilliance.
Susan Regan is a marriage family therapist in Berkeley, California. She works a lot with preschoolers and with kids whose parents are getting divorced. Regan says play is a powerful indicator of a child's struggles, revealing things they may not be able to articulate.
Kids can't talk, but they can play, and you can read the play just as you would a narrative that someone is saying.
Children use imagination when they're trying to understand a situation and determine what's real, especially when they've experienced trauma.
And that could be anything from a child going to the hospital for like an emergency appendectomy and how they make sense of it. Like sometimes it might be, you know, I stepped in a hole and then my stomach hurt, you know, and then that hole has some kind of magic powers that made my stomach hurt or something like that.
Children use imagination to draw conclusions, to figure out causation, how one thing leads to another, but they don't always get it right. Regan says parents are supposed to provide translation, especially when it comes to divorce.
What do you think you're doing?
Here's a scene from the TV show Mad Men, where Don and Betty Draper's marriage is on the rocks. Their daughter Sally misunderstands what's happening. She acts out. Her mother catches her smoking a cigarette in the bathroom and threatens her with consequences.
You're not going to be watching television. You're not going to be playing with your friends.
You're mean.
You betcha. Get in there.
Telling Daddy when he gets home.
Go ahead.
He left because you're stupid and mean.
Here, Sally draws the right conclusion. Her father left, but for the wrong reasons.
Why won't you let him come home?
When families are splitting up, therapist Regan says it's important to help children understand why, so they don't make false connections.
Daddy's on a trip.
And children oftentimes think that what they did created what happened.
Like in the 1993 film Mrs. Doubtfire. Sally Field's character splits from her husband, played by Robin Williams, the day of their son's birthday party. Here, the father is packing his things as his kids watch him prepare to leave.
This is all my fault.
God, no. Why would you think that?
I should have never had a birthday, Dad. This never would have happened.
The boy is practicing counterfactual thinking. He's seeing a connection between his birthday and the divorce, and he's thinking the divorce would never have happened if not for the birthday, and he blames himself. Regan says when this happens, therapists can help the child rewrite the narrative.
And I might do this in a drawing. I might do this with clay. You know, I might do this in all different kinds of ways. But we can kind of create maybe different middle and ends of the stories. And I try to break the connection that I feel like isn't helpful for them.
With a little creative thinking, Regan helps children get closer to the truth. Hey! For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor. Ken, it looks like children kind of start off being good at counterfactual reasoning, but being very poor at dealing with the facts, just the opposite of what you might expect.
Well, that's true. So, you know, that's an interesting thing. We're joined now by Lori Paul. She's a professor of philosophy at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She's co-author of Causation, A User's Guide. Lori, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi.
Hi, Lori. John Perry. Now, Lori, you've spent a good deal of your academic career thinking about the metaphysics of modality. That is, thinking, what makes statements about what might have been and what must be true, and how do we know them? So you must find this topic fascinating. So could you convey to our listening audience a little of the fascination that you have?
Sure. Well, I find it fascinating partly because I think it's really important to think clearly about what might have been. And I think it's important to think clearly even just for personal reasons. For example, if I want to think carefully about the kind of person I want to become or the kinds of things that I want to make happen in the world, who I should vote for, how to learn from my mistakes. So, for example, if I do something and something happens as a result of that, I might think back and say, well, what could I have done differently? And what would have been the result if I had acted differently? And that's the way I learn from my mistake.
Well, now, a lot of people might think that, well, yeah, we do engage in such reasoning, but this is all, if not quite fantasy and fiction, it's all just the imagination. It's unconstrained by the facts. Do you agree, or do you think there are really some facts, cold, hard, objective facts about what might be, must be, and can't be?
I do think there are cold, hard, objective facts about what might be, what might have happened. And that's why I'm so interested in trying to figure out partly what those might be and partly how we're supposed to try to discover them.
But the thing that John said in the opening, it makes that intriguing. I mean, the facts about, you know, my being a philosopher, I know what sort of constitutes those facts. You know, I say, yeah, he went to graduate school at Chicago, he got a degree, he got hired, he writes philosophy articles. Those are concrete things that I actually do, concrete properties that I actually have. But, you know, I think Quine was worried about these facts because he couldn't figure out how they could fit into the world. I mean, how can facts about what might be fit into the world, which is, a totality of actual things?
Well, here's one way that I like to think about it. I like to think about it as involving sort of two parts, okay? So here's a way to think about what might have been. You start with some rules, which we could talk about a little bit, but which I think of as kind of regularities or rules about what happens, like in a game. And then you consider different possible scenes or scenarios or different possible initial conditions. And that's where you have to do a little bit of imagining, because you have to think about, well, there's what actually happened, and then there's the imagined thing that I could plug in instead and then apply the rules, the actual rules, to see what you get out of that.
Well, let me give you an example, or let's just take our example. So Ken could have been a lawyer. I say, well, Ken obviously could have been a lawyer. He had the LSATs in his hand, and he decided to rip them up and not take the exam. If he decided differently, he would have gone to law school. He's a talented, intelligent guy. If he'd gone to law school, he would have become a lawyer. Clearly, Ken could have gone to law school. But somebody else might say, no, Ken clearly couldn't have gone to law school. Somebody who's so interested in philosophy as he was and so taken up with it, there's no possibility, even if he'd taken the LSATs, at some point along the line, he would have opted for philosophy. So we got two seemingly good arguments. How do we know which the fact, the cold, hard, objective fact about the possibility of Ken going to law school, which side does it come down on?
Answer that briefly, Laura. Sorry.
So this is why sometimes philosophy is interesting, because things get tricky. And what the metaphysician, like me, is going to say is, well, maybe both of those are right. It just depends on which rules you're taking to govern what you're going to get once you stick your input conditions in. So you're each picking out different actual rules or regularities and then reasoning to different conclusions.
Well, we're going to explore that reasoning in some detail in our next segment, Lori. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're talking about what might have been with Lori Paul from UNC Chapel Hill.
How about you, dear listener? I mean, could you have been a contender? Could you have been a lawyer? Could you have been rich? Or are you fated to have been a pretender and of modest income? Who knows? Maybe you know. Maybe you have an opinion. In our next segment, we're going to dig deeper into the nature of possibility and necessity, and we're going to explore the role of counterfactual reasoning in our thinking and planning.
How to think about what might have been. Plus, your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Perhaps, 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 perhaps.
We're thinking about what might have been and what could be, perhaps. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. And we think about what might be and what must be all the time. If we didn't, we could never plan our lives. We could never understand the causal structure of the world. But how exactly does that kind of thinking really work? And when we think, say things about what might be or must be, how can those statements be objectively true or false?
Our guest is Lori Paul. She's the co-author of Causation, A User's Guide.
So, Lori, we were talking of getting into the counterfactual reasoning just toward the end of the last segment. Let's start more slowly and go back to my earlier example before we get into the controversy. This seems true. I could have become a lawyer. And there's something else that seems true. If I had become a lawyer, I might have been had more money than I have now, but I wouldn't have been happier than I am now. So I want to just focus for a minute on what exactly are we saying when we say something like that? Tell me what a statement like that just means.
Okay. So I like the lawyer example. I'm going to focus just to start on a different example, how I met my husband. And let's just say I met my husband when I went into the local coffee house, ordered a giant coffee, and met him, you know, our eyes locked over the barista counter.
Oh, this sounds so romantic.
Right. So romantic, yes.
Well, and was it Starbucks or Pete's or Seattle's
Pete's.
Best?
It was Pete's, yes.
Okay, but what?
And we realized that we had a commitment over the coffee. Now, if I had never gone in to the coffee shop that morning, I would have never have met my future husband. And I think that's a safe assumption to make. I think there's a fact about that. And what I'm keeping fixed is that... Well, what I'm assuming is that I would have sort of gone straight and would never have gone to the coffee house and that I never would have met him in any other way. So there's a kind of regularity there.
Yeah, my son, though, my teenage son, he sometimes gets fascinated by counterfactual thinking. And he says, hey, you know, the problem is that if you change one thing, like I didn't go into the coffee shop, a lot of other things might change, too. And he also says, very perceptively, well, to get you not to go into the coffee shop, well, a lot of other things that lead up to it have to change. So how do you know what's going to change if you don't go into the coffee shop? And how do you know what you have to change in order to get you not to go into the coffee shop? And isn't it just sort
exactly.
of like, you know what I mean? So are there answers
exactly.
to my
okay.
15-year-old son?
I think there are. I mean, I think this is a tough question. And part of what we have to do is try to say very clearly, well, what are we going to hold fixed? And what are we going to allow to change? That's the first thing. So we say, well, which facts leading up to my decision to go into the coffee shop are we going to hold fixed? And which ones are we going to let change? That's the first step. And the second step is, which rules are we going to use when we what I think of as evolving the world forward, when we take our facts, real or supposed, and then plug them into the rules, right? Which rules are we going to use to sort of spit out what's going to happen at the end? And if you're not really clear about which rules you're going to use, if you use different ones under different ways of reasoning, then you're going to get all different kinds of results.
So I like that picture. I would start with the rules or the generalizations or the constraints.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, we're talking about how the world works. Right.
That's
and
right.
you're saying, so if we want to say Ken could have been a lawyer, we have an idea of how the world works. And so we know that if you're going to be a lawyer, you have to take the LSATs, you have to go to law school, you have to be pretty intelligent, and so forth and so on. And if we just hold the facts fixed that Ken's intelligent, had the LSATs application in his hand, we say he could have been a lawyer. But if we don't fix those facts, but fix the facts that the law appeared noxious to Ken, as it did to Hume, and he really loved philosophy, then different generalizations come in. Is that the picture?
But wait a minute. See, guys, here's where my son starts saying, well, yeah, but who gets to decide it's right to hold? So if I hold this fixed, if I hold that fixed, you know, but what's fixed? I mean, is it just up to me what's fixed? I mean, either the world is a certain way or it isn't, and our deciding to hold this or that fixed, that's why some people would think we're in the realm of speculation, imagination. I imagine that this might be fixed. But anyway, how do I know, you know, what's contingent upon what? If I hold this fixed, that gets to vary this way or does it? I mean, isn't that, it's not so easy.
I don't think it's easy, but I do, and I guess I want to say that there's something right about what your son is saying, which is that there are a lot of different ways to think about what could have happened. But just because there's a whole bunch of different answers we can come up with doesn't mean there aren't a whole bunch of different clear, careful ways we can come up with those answers.
So I think it's sometimes helpful to think about this in the context of action, which may be where it all got started. So let's think of Kent. There he is, sitting there with the LSATs application in his hand. And he thinks he has a choice. That means he thinks he could do one thing or he could do another. He could fill it out and send it in, or he could not fill it out and rip it up and not send it in. So he has to think in terms of not so much the past and how could it have been different, but the future and what am I going to do? So in that case, Ken's question is answered by it's the agent that decides what we hold fixed and what we change.
What do you think of that, Lori?
I find it helpful to think of, like, take a little metaphysical hole puncher and you snip out the choice of filling it, the choice to fill out the application. And maybe you plug it in with something else, okay? And depending on what you plug it in with, that's going to change what ultimately happens. So we have to imagine we plug it in with something else. Let's say he closes his eyes and meditates instead. Well, then we know in the world where we metaphysically snip out Ken filling out that application and replace it with him just, you know, engaging in meditation, that he's not going to go to law school because he's never done something that you have to do, namely fill out the LSAT application.
Right. That makes sense. So, look, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about what might have been. We have a caller on the line now that's Philip from Berkeley. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. I'd like to comment on the following. It seems to me that the notion of finding out what might have happened is sort of the flip side of deciding what could happen. That we take our past experience and extrapolate from that, or reason from that. And the difference is, at least the main difference I think, is that in the case of what could happen, we can find out what the results are. If we predict a certain range of results, and over time several of them happen, then we know, because we have predicted in some sense, that our presumptions were correct. However, we can't go into the past and find out what could have happened. And I think that's the main difference. If you could comment, I'd appreciate it.
Philip, thanks for the call. Philip distinguished between could and might. I don't know how to distinguish between could and might. But it sounds like he has a view, something like you suggested, I'm not sure. He thinks we can kind of project the world forward. We can kind of evolve the world forward. But he also seems to think we can't kind of think about alternative past or something like that. That was that last comment. I don't know what you want to comment on there.
So I'm thinking about when I'm driving on the expressway and I think, well, what's going to happen if I merge into the right lane? Well, one thing that could happen, right, is that truck in the right lane could hit me. So I'm pretty clearly knowing what could happen if I perform a particular action. Now, in terms of what happened in the past, I think we don't have the same kind of control as we do over the future. And maybe that's the distinction that Philip was worried about. I think we can suppose away something that actually happened and imagine a replacement. For example, what if JFK hadn't been assassinated? And then imagine, for example, again, what if JFK hadn't even gotten into the limousine for the motorcade? Well, then he wouldn't have been assassinated on November 22nd, 1963. So We can imagine and reason counterfactually about the past, but we don't have control over it. We can't make it the case now that JFK was never assassinated.
Right, so, I mean, what John was saying suggests, and I don't know if you believe this or not, John, and I know you've thought a lot about time too, Lori, but what John was saying was thought about the future is actually open, like metaphysically open. It's not yet determined and our actions determine what the future will be, partly. And then when we're thinking about the future and planning, we're planning like which future to make, and it's open to us to make alternative futures. But the past is already made. So when we think of unmaking the past and remaking it, it's a much larger exercise in imagination. Do you believe that the future is metaphysically open?
I think there's at least a sense in which the future is metaphysically open, because I think that, again, one reason why it's important to think counterfactually is to think, well, what kind of person do I want to be? How do I want my life to go? How do I want things to be for the people around me? And if that kind of reasoning makes sense, then I have to have control over what's going to happen in the future. And in that sense, the future is metaphysically open. What I do affects it.
My own view is you can't change the past. That shouldn't be too controversial. I think the future isn't real. It hasn't happened yet. Actually, we don't need to say it's not real. We have a perfectly good word for the future, namely it hasn't happened yet, and the past has happened. And that's a big difference. So I think I agree with Lori there. Now, sometimes when we're thinking about the past, we can kind of recreate something very similar. And, of course, that's what scientists do with experiments, where they run the same experiment with various things change and see what happens. But in the kinds of things that really excite us, like, you know, what would have happened if JFK had been not been assassinated, would the recession become a depression if Barack Obama hadn't, we can't very well run things again. So there's something mysterious about that.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about what might have been with Lori Barr from the UNC Chapel Hill. And we have a caller on the line now. That would be Amy from Berkeley. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Amy.
Thank you. I have a question in two parts. One is counterfactual thinking in many ways the process that a writer uses when they create fiction?
Well,
that's based in this real world.
Okay, and then you have another part, you said?
And then the second part of that question that sort of came to me as I was listening to the other discussions, particularly Philip's comments and the ones following, is can this type of counterfactual writing, like, let's say, the type that Michael Chabon does and other writers, could it be used as a tool for social change by sort of also in the way the content of your opening with Gore, if he had been elected president and served as president, can looking at what might have happened help people be motivated to make further change into the future?
Two excellent questions, Amy. What do you think, Lori?
Well, so the first question, I think, I do think that, in fact, there's a really interesting connection between thinking about fiction and stories and counterfactuals. One thing that I really like is, you know, if someone is creating a story, they usually have rules associated with that story. So we can say, that's a great story. It made sense. I see how it developed and why things happened the way they did, as opposed to like a really badly done film where the rules aren't really clear and it seems like, in fact, the world isn't evolving forward in a natural way. That's one way in which counterfactual reasoning comes into play. The other question about social change, I think that's also a really important question, and it has a lot to do with maybe with the way that we think about history and counterfactual thinking in history. So just going back to JFK's assassination, or we could think about World War II and what would have happened if Hitler had died as a child, or if Germany hadn't invaded Poland. Thinking about those counterfactual situations can help us give a template or learn from mistakes, again, that people have made so that we can then implement something better or more effective or still bring about positive social change.
I think those are important points. I just want to generalize them. I want to talk about this I just want to talk about this capacity that we have for counterfactual reasoning. And our Amy is helping us to point out, and you're pointing out, it's really a big deal, right? It's at the core of our ability to, like, imagine worlds different from the actual. And why does that matter? Because that helps us to explain things. It helps us to investigate the causal structure of the world. If we were just prisoners of the actual, you know, of the constant stream of events, There's all kinds of stuff that we're capable of doing. I mean, think of the cavemen and think of human culture and how it's evolved and changed. Why? Because we're not just prisoners of the actual moment, right? We have this capacity to think, well, what are some other ways things could be? What could we design to do this thing? Even though, you know, the law, it doesn't, it's like not manifestly present, but we think about, well, how things might be. It's a huge capacity for human beings. Don't you agree?
I agree, and I also think it's important, very important in science. I mean, the topic of global warming came up before, and then John mentioned how we construct experiments to try to test or retest conclusions that we've drawn. And all of this involves trying to figure out the regular ways the world behaves and then make predictions based on how well we think we can identify how the world's going to behave. And that's counterfactual reasoning. And, of course, it's essential to learn about these regularities and to predict the way the world's going to be, to have success in science and on all other kinds of endeavors.
We've got email from Christine Ellis, who maybe is a little skeptical about this counterfactual thinking. She says, how do we know that the possible is possible? We can imagine something else happening than what did happen, but since only one thing did happen, how can we really be sure that anything else was possible? I can imagine myself wearing a pair of jeans rather than a skirt today, but it seems like a decision I made between possibilities. It seems like that. But since I put on the jeans, was it really possible that I not wear jeans? What do you think of that?
Well, I think, again, we need to go back to the role of various kinds of regulators. If we're right, and there's a big question about maybe we're not very good at determining the different kinds of rules or regularities that govern the world. But if we are good about determining those, or at least approximating them, then we're as good at determining possibilities as we are as determining what those rules are. So if she's right that she, in other words, if she had some jeans, mm-hmm. I can't remember if it was a skirt that she was putting on her jeans. Let's say she's wearing a skirt. If she had some jeans and she knew she could fit into them and she knew she had time to put them on and the laws of nature were what they were, then it's just possible that she could have put the jeans
but
on.
But she's worrying about a kind of appearance-reality distinction. Lots of things seem to me possible, but they're not really possible. She's worrying about whether seeming possibility is real possibility.
Well, that's why I said, though, that it depends on how good we are at actually discovering these facts about the world. And there's always a problem about our inability to actually discover what the real facts are. I happen to think that we use a lot of inference to the best explanation in science and elsewhere to really discover what these rules and regularities are. And I think we're pretty good at it. Not always good at it.
I agree with you there. If we look at the small bore thing, every time you decide to do something, to eat a pancake, to pour syrup on your pancakes, to have a cup of coffee, you're really engaging in counterfactual reasoning. What will happen if I hold the cup there and the pot there? And when you think about that, we're actually amazingly good at it. Yeah. Maybe when it gets to the recession and Kennedy's death and World War I, it's a little chancy. But everyday stuff, we're great.
We're going to see. We're going to dig into just this issue in our next segment. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about what might have been with Laurie Paul, co-author of Causation, A User's Guide.
We can imagine all sorts of things. Are there possibilities beyond our imagining? Or their imagining that goes way beyond the possibilities. If anything goes in our imagination, how can we be sure that what we imagine is a genuine possibility and not just an empty figment?
Our knowledge of the possible, when Philosophy Talk continues.
What a topsy-turvy world this would be. World would be upside down. Yeah, world would be upside down.
It takes a lot to imagine the world upside down. Is it really a possibility? Is that possibility a fact? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Laurie Paul from UNC Chapel Hill, and we're thinking about what might have been.
Laurie, we better pursue this whole business about knowing about modalities. But so there's really kind of two questions here. The one we begin with is what philosophers call a metaphysical question. Are there modal facts in addition to facts about what happened? Now, if you think there are modal facts in addition to what happened, facts about what happened, then there's the epistemological question. How in the world could we know them? Are those two really strongly connected? We're kind of getting your idea about what the modal facts are. What's your view about the epistemology of it?
Well, I think obviously the question about how we know them is very, very difficult. And I think that the way we try to know them is we try to reason and try to discover what we think the best theory is, what the best explanation of various kinds of facts we think are true are.
Yeah, but you gotta, I think there's more to be said about this. I think our minds must be, they have to be, specifically equipped to enable us to engage in this kind of counterfactual modal reasoning, right? I don't think our dogs do much of this. They respond to contingencies. They learn, so they do some of this. But they don't do this thinking way beyond what's actually given, right? So we must, our minds must somehow be specifically equipped to think about possibility, necessity. And, you know, it's a really deep, interesting philosophical question. What is that specific equipment?
Okay, so let me make a distinction, okay? So on the one hand, there's the question of how we perform this act of counterfactual reasoning. And there, I think it's helpful, like I said, to think of starting with some initial conditions, some initial facts, and then plugging them into a set of rules and seeing what the rules are going to give you. So imagine you're playing a game of chess and you're making moves. You have to make moves in accordance with the game, right? And which moves you, or which places your pieces end up with on the board are going to depend on the rules plus the initial moves that you make. Now, that's, and there's a kind of counterfactual reasoning, I think, fits that model. But then there's the further question of how we figure out what the rules are.
Right.
And that's the super tough, well, we have to try to judge what the regularities are in the actual world or figure out what other ones might be and plug those in when we're performing the reasoning.
But again, when I say the mind is specifically equipped, Kant had the view that we had this inbuilt notion of causality, right? I mean, so if we got an inbuilt notion of causality, that's already coming to the world armed with a notion that forces us to ask, well, what depends on what, right? What causally depends on? I mean, that's like an a priori thing that we're equipped to reason about causality. We're equipped to reason about counterfactuals. We're equipped to engage in acts of the imagination that far outrun the actual. But see, here's, I think, where the deeper epistemological question comes in. We've got this inbuilt equipment that gets us off running, but now how do we constrain that equipment to only track the facts? I can imagine all sorts of things that go way beyond what's possible.
Well, let me just make a point there that goes back to our roving philosophical report, because I think we can look at the way children reason that isn't very good, but it's kind of easy to see what the basics are. So the kid says, well, look, mommy and daddy broke up because they got in a fight on my birthday party. So if I hadn't had a birthday, maybe they'd still be together. So that's kind of Laurie's mechanism at work. You have a generalization that, you know, or a picture of causation. They got in a fight, and that's why they broke up. They got in a fight during my birthday party. We removed that. They wouldn't have broke up. Now, when he gets better, it won't be the form of that reasoning that changes, but he'll say, oh, no, there were underlying problems there, like they hated each other and my mother couldn't stand my father. And so that'll be replaced with a different picture. But the form of the reasoning is pretty apparent right there in the child.
Could I just add that I do think children, though, they don't start out being able to make causal judgments. That is a capacity that develops pretty early on, but it's not there from birth. And I think that part of then what's going on is they do learn something about the world. They learn about arguably certain kinds of regularities, and then they're actually able to maybe use their innate equipment to reason in a certain way.
But again, you guys are kind of confident believers, and I am too, but I'm still struck by, so I want to know how possible things are, how things could be, or how things actually are. Some people say, well, imagine the possibilities. There's all kinds of things that are conceivable, and some people think, like Descartes seems to think, if it's conceivable, then it's really possible. I think our concepts, our imagination, they can far outstrip what's really possible. So I think there's a deep worry here about whether imagination and our concepts are going to outrun the real possibilities.
I think there is a deep worry here, but I also just want to be, again, careful because, you know, look, metaphysics gets crazy. That's one reason why it's so fun. And here's one way it gets crazy. We've been talking about, well, the regularities or rules of our actual world, but you could plug in all kinds of crazy regularities or rules that are totally unlike our actual world and then discover all kinds of crazy possibilities that come out of that. That's still totally legitimate reasoning. That's It's not just, oh, I've imagined it, but rather I've imagined some possible crazy rules and then plug things in. And given those crazy rules, here's what's possible.
Well, right. But then where? How do we know which are the right rules? You know, I mean, the world, I mean, that's mm-hmm. that's, you know.
I want to pick up on Ken's remark about Kant, and also one of our emailers says, how about Hume's problem of induction? Isn't it relevant here? Well, it is in a way. We've been worrying a lot about what's possible. Hume was worried about what's necessary. And he used necessary in a somewhat different sense than we do now, although a fairly ordinary sense. You know, if I let go of the pen that I'm holding over the table, it's necessary that it falls. That is, we expect it to fall. We think that's the way the world works. And Hume's problem of induction is, how can we ever know that? Since we're arguing that the future will be like the past, but all we have to reason on is the past. Now, I don't think we want to get into the answer to Hume's problem, but that's what Kant said in a way. Well, you can't get out from under the necessity of it, because the necessity really isn't in the things themselves. It's in the way we reason about it. I think there's something right about that. Hmm. It's not a very good answer to Hume's problem, but it's...
It's an insightful thought.
It's an insightful thought.
In service of solving the wrong problem, yes. But yeah, right.
I think it's an insightful thought, but I'm afraid I just don't think that Kant was right, that we can't actually learn about the world outside ourselves in the way that we need to. And I think Hume is relevant as well. I think Hume was probably too skeptical. I think we can use inference to the best explanation. We use it all the time in science to know how the future might resemble the past. And we use that to reason counterfactually. And that's about the real world, not just about our mind.
I agree with you with all that. I agree. I guess I'm more of a fan of Kant, because you say reason is inference to the best explanation. First of all, explain what you mean by that for our listeners who might not be so well versed.
Okay.
Briefly.
Yeah, that's a tough one. So what I mean by inference to the best explanation is we look at all the evidence out there, and then we try to make the best judgment, the judgment that we think gives the best explanation. And the thing that gives the best explanation we think is most likely to be true.
Yeah, but it's the thing that gives the best explanation, by our lights, and what counts as a good explanation.
Absolutely,
and then you have to know,
yes,
whether by our lights matches the world, and here's where Kant comes in. The only lights we have to go on is our lights. So what our lights say yes to, you know, that's it. But here's the even deeper thing about Kant. Again, I don't think you're giving enough weight to, because you're a metaphysician. I think more about the mind and the structure of the mind. I don't think you're giving enough weight to exploring the inbuilt architecture of the mind that enables it to do this magical thing, this seemingly magical thing. I think that's a really interesting thing. What is the inbuilt mm-hmm. structure of the mind that enables it to reason about counterfactual in a way that has a chance of tracking the truth? See, one of the things that Quine didn't do, or Hume didn't do, they didn't think enough about the mind, right? They thought, well, you only get these stuff rushing in your senses, and they only get sensory tickles, so of course you can't know anything about what's necessary or must be or might be. That's why Quine said, ask not what things might be or must be, ask only what they are, because he had a really limited notion of the mind, right? So, I don't know. It's the mind and its structure that enables us to do this.
Well, it's not. Of course, I think there's something great about the mind, and that it's really good at.
So do philosophy of mind and not metaphysics.
Yeah, yeah. but
mind is a terrible thing not to have.
That's right. But I also think that science is really important here, and having some confidence in the success of science. And it's not just somehow our minds have a certain kind of structure that matches or picks up on the structure of the world. Actually, a lot of times we're really bad at making judgments, but by actually detecting facts about the external world and correcting our reasoning when we discover that the facts we were assuming obtained didn't, by using experiments and trying to manipulate things, that's a powerful way to figure out how to match up the way we think with what seems to really be the case.
Okay, I got you. We've got time for one last caller. That's Julianne in Vallejo. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Julianne.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. My question is asking you to comment regarding the neurology of human perception and our three brains, the reptilian, mammalian, neocortex. The fact that we actually deconstruct and then reconstruct every single thing we perceive.
I don't know how to answer that. Thanks, Julian. Do you know how to answer that, Lori?
Well, I do think that the question raises something very interesting, which is that it is true that when we experience the world, a lot of that is constructed in a certain way. I'm quite interested in that, actually. Although maybe we perceive veridically, like we really do perceive things out there, the way that we experience it is determined by our mind. But what we have to figure out is how to get past that veil to really determine the way the world really is.
So minds are important, but I think the caller raises a good point. You can go even below the reptilian brain. Just look at the way that plants are, you know, sunflowers are able to turn towards the sun. If you reconstruct that, you can see a bit of counterfactual reasoning there. So the idea of adjusting not just to what is, but what's going to be the case and what the possibilities are, it really goes very deep. And that's my final deep comment.
Well, Lori, John making a deep comment, as always. You know, this has been a fascinating conversation, and I thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Our guest has been Lori Paul. She's a professor of philosophy at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She might have been a professor elsewhere, but in fact, she's a professor there. She's co-author of Causation, A User's Guide. So, John White, what are your closing thoughts about what might have been or what might be or will be?
Well, I think what might have been is if Quine hadn't used such lame arguments against possibility and necessity and modality, so that when those lame arguments were overturned, people thought, well, the way is clear. We wouldn't be going through the era of unbridled metaphysics and modality that we are. But Lori Paul is, I think, unusually cautious and sensible for a person that's been steeped in that tradition.
And she's cautious and sensible, even though she was a student of that great David Lewis, who got all this mess started that you don't really approve of. Oh, look, I think modality is a really deep thing, and I think it's part of deep part of the human mind that we engage in modal thinking, and I'm more interested in exploring the way the mind does this than exploring whether, you know, there are truths or false facts about this. But you know what? This conversation will continue. It should continue. It could continue. It must continue on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can also follow our tweets on Twitter and find out more by liking us on our very active Facebook page.
And don't forget, there's actually a free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk on our website, philosophytalk.org. And now we're going to get on the fast track to the world of mere possibility with Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, we think we're rational, but we also live in a fantasy world of could-have-beens, of wrong turns, of wishful thinking. In that regard, there's a peculiar thing that humans do when they're quite young. They often invent imaginary friends. I had one. His name was Bursum, which my mother says is the way I pronounced person. I had a little rubber saw that I called my ray gun. When I fired it, I would say, ray, ray, ray. I would say, come on, Bursum, let's go outside and ray some snucks, which is how I pronounced skunk. I was three, and cute as hell. There's a website, IUsedToBelieve.com, where people post their memories of imaginary friends. There are cartoon and video game creatures. There are talking puppies. Sometimes there are imaginary students, or imaginary students who are also puppies. One had a fox named Trevor. One had a bunch of dinosaurs. When the family went on trips, they had to wait for the dinosaurs to shrink so they could fit in the car. There's Steam, the chicken made out of water. Ginger, the feathered anteater. And the relationships can be dysfunctional. One girl had an imaginary friend, Collie, that she could only talk to on the telephone. One had a friend called Stupid Sally, whom she hated and tried to avoid. And there was a little girl profiled in The New Yorker who never actually met her imaginary friend, Charlie Ravioli, because he was always too busy in meetings. She only spoke to his imaginary secretary. What happens to these imaginary friends? Well, some go on vacation, don't come back. They get run over by cars. One little boy's imaginary friend, Steve, was killed when his father sat on him. One five-year-old boy had two imaginary friends, Loretta and Jeff. They got married and did not invite the little boy, so he got mad and asked his older sister to kill Jeff. She and her friends got into a car, a cardboard box, actually, and killed Jeff in a make-believe drive-by. Then the little boy married Loretta, but the older sister and her friends did a make-believe drive-by on her. I don't know what happened to my imaginary friend. I grew out of him, I guess, which is a shame. Shouldn't adults have imaginary friends? We're the ones who need them. Somebody's not a debt collector or a lawyer or a boss or some guy trying to take away your pension, raise your taxes, remove you from your home, or disrespect you. Just a guy. A little guy who fits in your pocket, who laughs at your jokes, tells you what a great job you're doing, listens to your ideas. He could be someone to take the blame or even act as a simple excuse. Gotta run. Just got a text from Bursum. The cool thing about your imaginary friend, if you get bored of him, just send him on a permanent vacation. Or have your sister come over with a cardboard box and take him out in a drive-by. If you don't have a sister, invent one. I gotta go.
The Wisdom of the Ages, in a nutshell, from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2012.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. The director of research is Laura McGuire.
Thanks also to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Dave Millar, Jimmy Tobin, Corey Goldman, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Templeton Foundation and from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.